members.
Allow introduction of the members.
Representative Westland, chair of the Oregon Health Plan Audit
Committee, is that correct?
Close enough.
Great, right. All right. And we have Daniel Swain, who is from New York, the Council of State Governments, is going to, I guess, begin the presentation. And some esteemed gentlemen who are going to explain all of this to us. Sir, go ahead.
On behalf of Council of State Governments, again, my name is Daniel Swain, and I want to thank you for having us out here. I want to thank Phil Taylor for inviting us to come out and for you all taking your time to hear our presentation. Just a little bit of background, the Council of State Governments, for those of you who don't know, is a membership organization for state government officials. All elected and appointed officials are members, so it's important we'll be able to present the members of our organization. We are a national organization with regional offices, and we're coming to you today from the Eastern Regional Office in New York, and specifically from the Criminal Justice Division of that office. The reason that we find ourselves out in Oregon is that none of the other regional offices have a criminal justice program for any of the projects that we do end up being national in scope. The particular project that has led to this presentation is called the Criminal Justice Mental Health Consensus Project. You all should have a copy of the project report. Overview and the chairman of the project, who's Senator Robert Thompson in Pennsylvania, Joe said we should hand out a couple Advil to the report because it's so heavy. So we hope that we don't cause any back pains to all of you. The project's been going on for a couple years now, and the purpose is to come up with recommendations on how the criminal justice system and mental health system can work together to better respond to people with mental illness. We had a meeting in September after the release of the report with a number of legislative staff members who are working on this issue. Mr. Taylor joined us there and henceforth asked us to come out here and speak to you about some of these issues. We are coming to you both at Council of State Governments and in conjunction with another organization, the National CAPA Center for Jail Diversion, which works specifically on these issues and is a branch of the National Gaming Center and has been leaders on the issues of criminal justice and mental health for many years now. Come to you with three presenters today, Dr. Fred Osher, immediately to my left from the University of Maryland, Captain John Cassese from Monroe County Sheriff's Office in New York, on my far left, and David Wertheimer from Seattle, Washington. And we'll be speaking to you today about issues of people with mental illness in the justice system, and specifically focusing on some of the fiscal implications. We invite you to ask questions. What we thought we would do is run through the presentation and then have the questions at the end, but if there's something that you'd like to clarify during the presentation, please don't hesitate to ask. And again, we thank you very much for your time. And lastly, I just want to make sure I thank the many folks from Oregon who have worked on this project and really helped us out enormously. Senator Burdick was one of the members of the advisory board, and also Barry Cass from the Department of Human Services, Gary Field from the Department of Corrections, and also we received a lot of advice and comments from Richard Sherman from Lane County, among other folks. So the Oregon has been very well represented on this project, and again, we appreciate your time. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to the presenters.
Thank you. As David mentioned, my name is Fred Osher, and I want to first start out by thanking all of you for coming after our election yesterday with implications that we're humbled by. We don't fully understand. We'll try to be sensitive to the climate that you are operating within here, and at the same time want to share with you some of the ways in which other communities around the country are approaching a problem of growing concern, and that's the presence of folks with mental illness at every juncture in the criminal justice system. So thank you again for taking time out of your schedule to meet and be with us here today. As David mentioned, this is in part sponsored by two organizations, the Council of State Governments and the SAMHSA-funded TAPA Center, which comes out of Albany, New York. We here are aware that nationally that we have budget crises that are confronting state after state after state, and we read the news and we understand that Oregon is under some of the most difficult circumstances at this time. We are open and willing to hear, and it's very early, but some of the short-term implications of the crisis is before you, and then think through some of the long-term strategies. And hopefully, gist of our message is that what we present today may be things that you can use as you make some tough decisions down the road about how to allocate the scarce resources that you have and in an effective way to achieve the goals that we all value, and that is improved public safety and improved public health. And that in many ways the Consensus Project represents this win-win position that you can make decisions that serve both of those goals, and that's some of the data that we hope to present to you. I wanted to share an overview of just sort of the crisis that nationally confronts us in terms of skyrocketing incarceration rates in our country. In 1990, one out of every 218 residents was incarcerated in this country. In 2000, we now have one out of every 142 residents. Over 2 million people are now held in prison or jails. Nearly 4 million people in our country are on probation or parole. That represents 3% of our population. It's the highest rate of incarceration and correctional supervision of any developed country in the world. And importantly, this is not a random slice of the population, that we have over-representation of people with color in our justice system nationally, so that 1 out of 10 males that are African-American between the ages of 20 and 29 are under some form of supervision. The non-random nature of our incarceration policies extend to folks with mental illness. And that we know from justice studies that using survey methodology that roughly national data shows about 16% of folks in our state prison inmates are mentally ill. 16% of local jail inmates have serious mental illness. About the same number of our probationers have serious mental illness. In Oregon, the most recent data that we came upon suggested about 12% of folks in your prison system have serious and persistent mental illness, and another 9% require mental health treatment for symptoms that are related to their difficulties during confinement. The rates of serious mental illness among incarcerated offenders in correctional settings, therefore, are anywhere from 2 to 3 to 5 times higher than the rates of mental illness in the general population. And so part of what I want to do in my opening comments is address why is that? How come we're arresting and incarcerating so many people with mental illness? When you look at the national data here, you see the general population has about 1.8% lead criteria for serious mental illness. This came out of a Cook County jail study in Chicago, where the male jail detainees were found to have 6.4% incidence of serious mental illness, and women higher than that. When you look further at those individuals with mental illness in the jail and prison settings, you have to look at some of the associated factors that get them there. And one of the most prominent that comes out is the co-occurrence of substance use disorders. So that when you look at jail and prison populations, and this data just suggests that when both alcohol and drug use is factored in, roughly 3/4 of those individuals that are incarcerated with serious mental illness have a co-occurring substance use disorder, and that has important implications for both clinical interventions and policy as you consider it. It is also the case that a large number of individuals that just come into your community mental health system will have recent contact with the criminal justice system, either released from jail or prison, charges pending. And so this is a two-way street. Both the criminal justice system is confronted with high numbers of folks with mental illness, and the mental health system is confronted with huge numbers of folks that have histories of contact with the criminal justice system. And just as stigma, fear, and discrimination affect responses of corrections and courts to folks with mental illness, so too does stigma and stereotype affect the mental health community's response to individuals that have criminal justice histories.
Mr. Chair, what's ETLH?
I'm sorry, alcohol.
Okay, that's alcohol and drug, or just alcohol?
ETLH is just alcohol,
okay.
And then then are those with alcohol abuse, and you add to it those that have drug abuse. Now, oftentimes folks have both of those things going on at the same time, multiple drugs that might be used and alcohol, but the take-home message was that 3/4 of folks with serious mental illness will have one or more of these conditions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So how is it that there are so many folks with mental illness in our criminal justice system? What explains that? And I want to go through the factors that contribute to this phenomenon nationally that are also relevant to folks here in Oregon. People with mental illness are arrested at disproportionately higher rates. That's how you get into jail and prison. Well, why would that be? I've already referred to the high rates of co-occurring substance use disorder. And our ballooning jail and prison populations, that slide I showed you earlier, are directly related to our country's policies on drug use. And the war on drugs has resulted in, with mandatory sentencing guidelines and some of the changes that have been imposed, a high percentage of folks coming into our jail and prison population with substance use disorders. It is the case that people with mental illnesses, for a variety of factors, use drugs and alcohol at higher rates than the general population. So that if you sweep into our jail and prison population drug-related offenses, you're going to capture a whole bunch of individuals that also have serious mental illness with that broom. And that in part explains some of the increase in arrest rates. There is a topic that's very controversial, and that's mental illness and violence. And despite the fact that there are high-profile media stories that suggest that the mentally ill individual is a violent individual, data doesn't support that. Violence among folks with mental illness is a rare event, and that what we understand is that there's much more myth than fact that sort of gets put out in terms of the story about this. People with mental illness in study after study have been shown to have rates of violence no higher than the general population. There are some conditions, however, for folks with mental illness that do predict they may be more violent in the future. Those three conditions are a history of violent behavior, so there is some persistence forecasting. If you've done something like that before, you're more likely than someone else to do it again. Second factor is noncompliance with psychotropic medications, either not taking them or not getting access to them, and that can contribute to a destabilizing picture for those individuals. And most importantly, again, violence in our country is explained by substance use behavior, and that's what drives violence rates principally, not mental illness, but addictions. And so because these individuals with mental illness have high rates of addiction, they too are predisposed to sometimes violent behavior.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Is the violence you're speaking of, does that occur because people need money to support their addiction, or does it occur because of the addictive behavior itself?
For the substance use-related violence in our country, it is fueled often by seeking funds to sustain habit. That's the predominant area that explains most of the behavior. And then there are the disinhibiting effects of drug agents themselves, which leads to unpredictability and volatility, impulsivity, and violent behavior. So it's a combination of the two. Thank you.
Representative Cruz.
Would self-directed violence be part of that category, or is that a different category?
That's a different category, and that has important implications, obviously, for how we handle folks within the public health system.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Adding to the reasons why folks with mental illness are arrested at disproportionately higher rates is that jail and prisons are often housing of last resort. When a criminal justice officer is faced with an individual that is out in the cold at 2 in the morning, doesn't have any place to go, could be cited for some nuisance crime, there's a mercy booking that occurs. And these folks are brought in, and at least they get a place to stay overnight. Once, however, they get into that jail system, it's sometimes difficult to get out. We have in this country an affordable housing crisis. About 2 million people a year experience homelessness for at least one day of the year. And of those, about a third of the homeless population have a serious mental illness. A homeless person is a very visible public person. Crimes of survival, panhandling, urinating in public, those issues get them the attention of public safety officers. During the year preceding their arrest, 30% of inmates with mental illness in jail reported being homeless, and in state and federal prisons, 20%. So homelessness contributes to rearrest rates, and because folks with mental illness are homeless more often than the general population, they get arrested more often as well. Other reasons that contribute to the high rates of mental illness in our jails and prisons folks with mental illness get incarcerated for longer periods of time. Same action, same crime, same sentence, they end up staying in our jail and prisons longer. Bureau of Justice Statistics survey found that in our federal prisons, people with mental illness, same charges, same crimes, spend 15 months longer than those without mental illness. A recent Rikers Island survey showed, again, high rates, longer days stays for folks with mental illness. The reasons for that are, one, they don't follow the rules quite like the other ones. They end up getting segregated more often. They get confined. They have administrative actions taken. And secondly, there's little opportunity for them once they leave. So finding them a place to go, connecting them with appropriate services, delays their discharge. The other reasons for high rates include the pathogenic nature of incarcerated environments. I don't know if you all have jails different from around the country, but when you walk into them, they are noisy, they are overcrowded, and they are quite stimulating. For folks that have a vulnerability for mental illness, that's where they may express it. For folks that are already mentally ill, going into those environments can make them quite unstable and volatile. They also, folks with mental illness, get rearrested at rates higher than those without. So the modal discharge plan for our jails these days is, as it was from Rikers Island in New York City, a drop-off in the center of town between 2 and 4 in the morning, $1.50 and change in your pocket, and a pat on the back. Good luck. That isn't the type of a transition plan that's likely to get folks served within their communities. We have 600,000 people coming out of our federal prison system this year after their sentences max out. Many of those with mental illnesses, they're coming back to our communities, whether we like it or not, ready or not, they're coming back. And the way in which we plan for them on reentry has significant impact on their rearrest rates. Lastly, and a little bit of a focus, and I'll digress somewhat, inadequate mental health services. That explains high arrest rates within our country. We have a fragmentation of comprehensive services nationally. We've had health financing reforms that have made access to insurance more difficult. We've had rollbacks nationally of our public health insurances, making it difficult for folks that need it to access the care that they require. There is a real irony here. The Surgeon General's report cited that 2/3 of all people with diagnosable mental disorders receive no treatment. We have stigma, which impedes both the parity in financing mental health resources and people's willing to access the care and provide the care. The irony here is the gap between what we know works and what people have access to continues to grow. There is a science of treatment out there. We have, over the last 2 decades, developed medications with fewer side effects, have service interventions with proven track records, have an ability to educate families in a way that keeps their loved ones within their homes and out of our institutional settings, can provide a range of social skills interventions and employment interventions with proven effects. But far too few people with mental illness get access to those effective interventions. So the gap between what we know works and what people get grows and grows. You've got some real tough choices ahead of you, and some of the impact of the Measure 28 failing will include folks being discharged from insurance rolls. And what's going to happen to those individuals is a concern to all of us, and that there are clear ways in which we can speculate. I understand that included among the discharge will be 3,000 individuals on methadone maintenance. Most of those individuals will go back to using drugs because methadone kept them from doing so. They'll spend over, the estimate is, $200 million on getting drugs. Where does that $200 million come from? A lot of it relates to your question around property crime. What happens with that individual? They need to be arrested. Public safety is an issue. And so not getting good treatment is definitely connected to high rates of folks in our jail and prison settings. So the story I'm telling is we arrest them more often, we stress them while they're incarcerated, we keep them incarcerated longer, we discharge them without adequate planning, they don't get access to adequate mental health care, we re-arrest them at higher rates, and now we have an issue that raises both health and public safety implications. The challenge. What can criminal justice do differently? What can mental health substance abuse treatment do differently? And how can they work together in a collaborative way? The name of this project was Consensus Project. What we found between the criminal justice fields and the mental health field is a lot of consensus on what should be done and how to do it. It was pretty amazing that there weren't more fights around the table.
Dr. Representative Dalto's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Osher, did you find any success stories across this country?
Yes, and that we're going to, in the next part of the story, tell some of those success stories. I've been laying out the background, and so, oh, great, huge problem, fine. What are we going to do about it? That's where we need to move in the next part, and I want to turn that over to David Wertheimer in a moment. SAMHSA at the federal level has a number of things going on, success stories, jail diversion projects around the country, some right here in Oregon that have shown that if you have a place that will receive folks, you can keep them out of jail and prison and get them treatment rather than punishment. We have technical assistance capacity. Part of why we're here is representative of that. There has been mental health court legislation and demonstration programs at the federal level. Money kind of comes in to demonstrate what works, and so we're getting a knowledge base, and that it should inform some of the tough decisions that you have to make. I want at this point, though, to turn it over to one of our correction partners. And Captain John Cassisi has been part of the project for a long time, and it's really been a pleasure to work with him.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is John Cassisi, and I'm a captain at the Monroe County Jail in Rochester, New York. I too have a little bit more bad news before we get to some of the things that really work. But first, I'd like to thank the Oregon Judiciary Committee for allowing me to speak before you today. I'd like to thank my Sheriff, Patrick O'Flynn, for allowing me to represent our jail. And I'd like to thank the Oregon Sheriff's Association. Last June, I was fortunate enough to testify before the United States Senate Judiciary Committee about the issue of people with mental illness in the criminal justice system. I'm grateful to have had that chance to address this committee because, unlike the United States senators whom I addressed in Washington, I know the members of this committee are not full-time legislators. And I know that, for example, Mr. Chairman, through your years of experience as a police officer and detective, you've experienced firsthand the interaction between people with mental illness and the criminal justice system and the various problems associated in dealing with an acute incident. Speaking for corrections officers across the country, I can tell you that identifying inmates with mental illness, treating, managing, and preparing them for release is one of the greatest, if not the single greatest, challenges we face in corrections. I'd like to focus the remainder of my time on the following areas, give you some information about the Monroe County Jail and how it compares to jails in Oregon, describe who are the people with mental illness who end up in our jail, explain what services we provide to these inmates, and talk about the impact people with mental illness have on our jails in terms of safety, security, and the resources that are required to manage them in a safe manner during their incarceration, and try to address the implications for jails when community mental health services are reduced or eliminated. On any given day in Monroe County, there are about 1,400 inmates in our jail. Around 400 of these inmates are serving sentences of 1 year or less in our sentence facility, which is about 3 miles from our downtown facility. The remaining 1,000 inmates are pretrial detainees and are held in the downtown jail. We also provide security at the Rochester Psychiatric Center, which is a regional forensic unit in Rochester. Like most jails, the average length of stay for inmates in our facility is relatively short. Over the course of a year, over 17,000 inmates are booked into our facility. In comparison, Multnomah County has over 1,800 inmates in their 5 jail facilities, with 1,100 sentenced inmates and about 750 pretrial detainees. Like every county in the country, our jail has experienced explosive growth over the last 2 decades. Our facility also resembles most jails in that it's the county's largest mental health facility. No other institution in Monroe County holds nearly as many people with mental illness. And that's just not right. We work in a jail, and our job really is to incarcerate offenders, not hospitalize sick people. Between 15 and 20% of the inmates in our jail have a mental illness, which is consistent with most jails in the country. In a lot of areas, it's a lot less than maybe in that 12 to 14% range. But in Monroe County, we're between 15 and 20%, so we have a much higher rate. I want to be clear that we incarcerate many offenders who have committed serious, violent crimes, and some of those have a mental illness. They need to be punished and require incarceration. There are no two ways about that. But the majority of people we see with mental illness in our jail aren't murderers or sex offenders or even criminals with a history of violence. They are people who have been in and out of our jail on countless occasions, charged with or convicted of committing low-level offenses. We don't blame law enforcement officers for taking these people to our jail. They often don't have any other option. I want to tell you a story about a typical individual with mental illness who was recently brought to our jail. It was a 34-year-old man with a history of mental illness who wrote a letter stating he was God and how he was going to save the world. He also had stopped taking his medication for several days. He'd been giving his family a difficult time, and the police became involved because he became very threatening to his family. He'd been arrested one time prior in his early 20s for very similar circumstances. The police took the man for an evaluation at a local psychiatric emergency room where he was deemed not sick enough to be held, so they had no other option other than to take him to jail. Due to his mental health history and unstable condition, because he was not taking his medication, we placed him in a single cell on a 24-hour constant observation watch. I now like to explain how we work to identify, treat, and plan for the release of people with mental illness who come into the jail. I'd like to talk about screening. In New York State, we are unique in that each jail uses the same screening process. At our jail, we screen everyone who is admitted to the jail for mental illness. The State Office of Mental Health developed one form in particular, which is nationally recognized, the Suicide Prevention Screening Guideline Form. This screening process used in our jail and other jails in New York State has caused suicides to drop by 70% over the last decade. In addition, in our jail, we use two additional forms for medical and mental health screening by booking officers. Also, security command officers have a regularly scheduled daily meeting Monday through Friday with medical and mental health staff to discuss inmates with serious mental health issues or who are at risk of committing suicide. Next, I'd like to mention the release planning that was talked about earlier. Good release planning is paramount. We know an effective discharge plan includes appointments with community-based treatment providers, a short supply of medications, health coverage, and linkage to supportive housing. We have better success with planning for the release of our sentence inmates because we know in advance the date of their release. Meeting all of these objectives is difficult, but is nearly impossible with pretrial detainees. We often receive less than 2 hours advance notice of these inmates' departure. This is a major problem and frustration for jail administrators across the country. When we release people with mental illness without a community-based treatment plan and linkage to a community-based provider, we know the odds are good that he or she will be back soon. Without health coverage, it is nearly impossible for most of these people to receive care or obtain medications. Although many are eligible for Medicaid, few are actually enrolled in the benefits program. Next, I'd like to mention the impact of this situation on the people with mental illness and on jail operations. Inmates with mental illness do not do well in jails across the country. They sometimes act out and violate rules, which was talked about earlier, which means we have to reassign them to segregation or high security cells, which we typically reserve for really dangerous inmates. Inmates with mental illness are also vulnerable to predatory inmates. Jails are not a therapeutic environment. They are depressing, and they are just not nice places that make people feel better. The influx of people with mental illness makes running the jail more costly and more dangerous. Every day in Monroe County, we have five areas in the jail where we are watching inmates with mental health problems, with three deputies assigned to constant observation duties, with an average of 10 to 12 inmates who are on a suicide watch and another 20 to 25 inmates who need to be watched more closely. That might not sound like much, but making sure someone is always watching these inmates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in a high security area is extremely staff intensive and very expensive. Nevertheless, this degree of supervision is necessary to ensure a safe environment. Last year in 2002, in the Monroe County Jail, besides jail deputies working normal hours in our constant observation areas, we used 8,350 hours of overtime to watch inmates with mental illness on constant observation at a cost of $315,000. The local socio-legal mental health clinic of Monroe County provides the mental health services at the jail at a cost last year of $425,000 for services and $240,000 for psychotropic drugs. And that total of $665,000 is only mental health coverage Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Not the required and needed 24-hour-a-day mental health coverage that's needed 7 days a week. After 4 o'clock and on weekends, if there is an acute situation in the jail, an inmate with serious mental health issues must be taken to a local hospital psychiatric emergency room, which is even more costly than treating that inmate in the jail. A recent study conducted for Monroe County by a professional correctional health care consultant concluded that a total of $1.5 million annually is needed at the present time to cover the existing mental health needs at the jail 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, I agree that we need to expand and improve the mental health services in our jails. However, I am reluctant to advocate for extensive mental health services in our jails across the country. As it is, we receive too many people with mental illness, and this is true in county jails across the country, including Oregon. Most importantly, and what really needs to be taken into account, is that jails return people with mental illness to the community many times in no better shape than when they were brought into the jail. For this reason, I would prefer to see in Monroe County and communities across the country the communities improve their capacity to support people with mental illness in the community. If there are reductions in mental health services in the community, it would without a doubt cause a further need to increase mental health services provided in our jails. And the cost of managing and treating mentally ill people in the criminal justice system is far more expensive for government and the taxpayers than treating them in a more therapeutic environment with all of the supports and their families in a community-based treatment program. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
I want to start getting to some of the solutions that you asked about, Representative, earlier. And, again, you've got before you both the report and the summary of it, which walks an individual through the continuum of contact that a person with mental illness has with the criminal justice system, from police arrest through release from prison, and that there are 46 policy recommendations there that were put together through a process that was coordinated by your Council of State Governments, this nonprofit, nonpartisan group that is not Republican, not Democratic, represents all, brought together legislators from around the country to work with experts, put together work groups that were in four principal areas: law enforcement, courts, correction, and mental health, to define measures that all stakeholders in criminal justice and mental health systems agree would improve the response to people with mental illness involved in the criminal justice system. It was originally started by a lot of the high-profile events around the country. You get a tragic crime in your community, and then the citizens want a response, and as legislators, you feel some pressure to come up with responses. It was a belief that if we could outline some of these possible policy changes, that it would give you a tool to use with recommendations that were vetted through a process that went through considerable deliberation. The central features of the report were its bipartisan nature. Senator Thompson, Republican from Pennsylvania, Representative Lawler, Democratic fellow from Connecticut, led the initiative, and that it was cross-system and multidisciplinary. That was very important. It wasn't a set of solutions that came out of the mental health provider world or from the corrections world, but it was a consensus from both of those foci. There was a steering committee, there were advisory boards, there were over 100 total members, there were bunches of meetings. People worked very hard to get the product before you. These were some of the coordinating agencies that represent their constituents in law enforcement, corrections, mental health, and courts. We had testimony, as mentioned earlier, before the U.S. Senate. That occurred in August. You'll see at the far left of that slide our own captain who gave us time to show up on the Hill as well. The overarching themes of the report: collaboration, training, an effective mental health system. We need to have data to support the things that you do, and that it's very critical. We come here from outside, but the solutions to your issues are local solutions, and we respect your understanding of context, your understanding of strengths and weaknesses to design those proposals. I want to emphasize the top one again, collaboration. You can't do this with one side of the house moving forward. That is, you can't sponsor good diversion programs from your jail and prison settings unless there's a mental health partner to receive those diverted individuals. I understand the drug courts are going to be continued much longer in the state of Oregon, and part of that, I believe, was probably a recognition that, you know, there's no sense sending them into community programs if there aren't community programs. And so this collaborative nature to the response is quite necessary. You've got to have healthy partners or partners at the table that can participate in these solutions. We're going to, at this point, talk about some of the fiscal implications. I just wanted to highlight them. This is critical. It is significantly more expensive to provide mental health and substance abuse treatment in the criminal justice system than in the community. That's echoing the captain's remarks, and we'll have data to show you that that's the case. The majority of individuals with mental illness in the justice system are revolving door clients. By that we mean they aren't just using expenses in the jail or in the mental health center. They're also in the emergency rooms, they're in your homeless shelters, they're in a variety of high-cost, crisis-oriented settings that cost lots and lots of dollars. And that coordinated efforts between criminal justice and mental health systems really can use these resources more effectively. We have to think of this from the taxpayer's perspective. We're not interested in the mental health budget as opposed to the criminal justice budget. We're interested in the overall budget, and that's where your representation and your leadership is so critical. We have to look beyond these silos to design interventions that are cost effective across not just within a silo, but those systems of care. I want to turn it over for some of the more detail about cost effectiveness that we've learned from other communities that you can consider in your deliberations in the future, and turn the mic over to David Wertheimer.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. It's a pleasure to actually be in a state capital you can work in. In Olympia, the state capital kind of looks like a building with the architectural version of an ace bandage wrapped around the dome. And the legislature, as you know, is displaced into these ridiculous temporary structures. So it's nice to be in a slightly more stable environment, at least architecturally. Unlike our colleagues to my left, since I came down from Seattle last night, I was probably doing what most of you were doing last night, which was watching your election returns on your local television after we heard other voices from the other side of the country talking about the nation. And it was truly distressing. I actually thought your measure was going to pass. I was optimistic about it, it was devastating to watch the returns last night, and a little scary because a lot of us up in Washington are watching what's happening in Oregon and are nervous. I was hoping the voters in Oregon would be intelligent, but then again, we have this gentleman named Tim Iman in our state who seems to be able to convince the voters about...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
I don't feel like listening to the an attack directed at Oregon voters. I don't think it's necessary to impugn the motive or the character or the intelligence of Oregon voters because you don't like the outcome of a vote. I think it's insultive and out of place.
All right, Senator, I'm not sure that I disagree, but this other gentleman...
Duly noted. I apologize. It was not my intention. Correction is noted and maintained. Let me proceed with my comments. Price tags. What are the price tags when people with mental illness become involved with the criminal justice system? Well, there are numerous price tags, and as our previous speakers have indicated, it's very, very expensive. Here's a little bit of data from two research studies. One was conducted in Cook County, Illinois, where some of the data that Dr. Osher mentioned comes from. The second study is actually from Monroe County, a small program where John is from. And this shows a comparison of the costs for individuals with severe mental illnesses, prior to diversion from jail and linkage to community-based services, and after diversion and linkage. Prior to diversion, you see the costs are enormous. And this is looking across multiple systems, across multiple silos of funding, corrections, mental health, housing, etc. And you see the cost in these two communities in Chicago, about $53,000, $54,000 a year. In Rochester, about $74,000 a year prior to linkage to treatment and housing. Post linkage to treatment and housing, those costs go down by about $19,000 per person per year in Chicago, and almost $40,000 for the small sample of folks in Project Link in Rochester, New York. Those two particular studies that really demonstrate, when you look across multiple systems, the difference in cost between incarcerating an individual and treating them in the community. A little more research out of Tucson and out of Eugene. Here we see two specific jail diversion programs being measured, one in your own state, in fact. This shows the average cost per person to not divert them, that is to hold them in incarceration settings, to put them in the environments which Dr. Osher and our jail captain have just told us are the absolute wrong place to put someone, and the cost of actually treating them in the community. And here you see in these two studies of jail diversion programs, it's pretty much a wash. Roughly the same costs, calculated slightly differently from the previous studies. All the researchers do these things a little differently, but here you see, in terms of human costs, that investment of $857 a year or $421 a year to actually place someone in an environment where they're going to get better rather than worse, where they're going to be linked to treatment and services rather than held in a very, very destructive setting for their mental health, is virtually negligible. Another study was completed fairly recently by Dennis Culhane and a team of researchers from the University of Pennsylvania, the New York, New York study. This is perhaps one of the most comprehensive studies to date that tried to look across multiple systems at the cost of homelessness and the cost of mental illness in comparison with the cost of providing housing and treatment. The study looked at the cost of homelessness and found that these individuals in New York City are very, very heavy service users. They spent 37% of the last 2 years in institutional settings, providing services for these individuals while they were homeless in New York across these multiple systems is very expensive, $40,000 per person per year. Providing housing and supportive services for these individuals cost significantly less across multiple systems, reduced costs by 30%, or a total of about $12,000 per person in this study. And 94% of the cost of supportive housing was in fact offset by service reductions and savings on the service side. So again, we see significant savings accrue from providing housing and services as an alternative, in this case, to homelessness and 37% of your year spent in an institutional setting such as a jail or a hospital. That's measuring the dollar piece. I want to talk a little bit now about measuring the cents piece. Not C-E-N-T-S, but S-E-N-S-E. Many of you are probably familiar with the story of Dan Van Ho. You've had some similar incidents actually within the last few weeks here in Oregon that bring to mind this case. Dan Van Ho was a man who in August of 1997 stole a bicycle in Seattle, Washington. He has a mental illness. He had a history of substance abuse problems. The bicycle he stole wasn't worth very much, so he was charged with a misdemeanor offense. He was found not competent to stand trial, and as the law stood in Washington State in 1997, a person charged with a misdemeanor offense who was not found competent to stand trial is released. The jail officers who had been observing Mr. Van Ho in the incarceration setting in the King County Jail knew he was a risk, but there was nothing they could do about it. They knew he was headed back to the community, and there was nothing that they could do about it. They even tried, as they were escorting him out of the sally port of the jail, to crowd him a little bit in the hopes that he might go off and assault one of them. He didn't. He knew he had to get out that door. And 11 days later, outside of the King Dome, which isn't there anymore, 11 days later, he rushed into the crowd of people exiting from a ball game, approached a retired firefighter by the name of Stanley Stevenson, and stabbed him to death in front of his family. The initial bureaucratic instinct in Washington and Seattle was to run and duck for cover. There were so many potential gaps and barriers and problems in our system that people tended to sort of run for cover. Well, it wasn't the jail, it wasn't us. There was a county executive, still is in Seattle, named Ron Sims, who sort of took the opposite tack, and he ran directly at the crisis. Within 24 hours, he had called for the creation of a mentally ill offender task force, and that task force spent a significant amount of time studying all of the problems at the state and local levels that led to the particular crisis of Mr. Van Hoe. When we look at the King County situation, your neighbors to the north, we found that 10% of our misdemeanor jail population utilized 70% of our misdemeanor jail bed days. This goes back to Dr. Dorosher's comments about people flowing through the system repeatedly. It becomes a revolving door. John mentioned this as well. The same people coming back again and again and again. Persons with mental illness are disproportionately overrepresented in this group, even more disproportionately overrepresented than they are in the general jail population, which we've already discussed this morning. And in King County, unlike the 75% statistic that Fred mentioned, more than 90% of these individuals had co-occurring substance use disorders. That was on the jail side. When we looked at the mental health system side, we found only two significant cofactors that led to both incarceration and hospitalization for youth, adults, and older adults with severe mental illnesses. Two cofactors. We looked across the board at diagnosis, at ethnicity, at age, at gender, etc. Nothing was statistically significant except for two cofactors: co-occurring substance use disorders and homelessness. We decided that if we could begin to integrate treatment and stable housing for these individuals to address the problems of co-occurring disorders and homelessness, that we might be able to begin to tackle this problem, that these were essential components to reducing jail and hospital use. In King County, as here in Oregon, we spend disproportionate amounts of our tax dollars on criminal justice system services. The current expense budget in King County is two-thirds criminal justice. Despite the presence of 2,400 jail beds in King County, at a 5% annual growth rate, which is our current projected growth rate for the jail, a new jail would be needed by 2010. When that data came out a few years ago, again, the county powers that be said, wait a minute, we don't need to build another jail. In fact, we can't afford the capital and operating costs of another jail. What are the alternatives to incarcerating this population again and again and again? What is the strategy for cost avoidance, diversion from jail of offenders with multiple problems? So this MIO task force that was convened came up with a set of recommendations related to systems change: state level review and adjustment of statutory gaps and barriers, creation of pilot mental health courts in King County and Seattle Municipal Court, and creation of a crisis triage unit. These are all ways to address the issues we've been discussing here this morning. I want to talk very quickly about them. The first was state level statutory action. State laws were changed to ensure that dangerous individuals who are exiting the criminal justice system are linked to assessment and treatment, that someone like Dan Van Hoe could not slip through the cracks of the system, exit the criminal justice system when he was definitely considered by those in the jail to be dangerous, and leave. Attaching resources to mentally ill offenders leaving custody to ensure community-based treatment. This actually took dollars from our state correctional budget and attached them to our state mental health budget in order to provide what was demonstrated to be a less expensive alternative to releasing individuals from state correctional settings without any linkages to treatment, in the hopes that recidivism could be reduced. Yes?
Yes, thank you. And maybe you're going to be covering this, but using the same example of Mr. Ho, who had left. So he'd served his time, and so he was going to be released. How could you have kept him?
The problem particular to Dan Van Hoe was a legal issue, in that he had been charged with a misdemeanor offense, and under the statute that existed in 1997 in Washington State, the misdemeanor offense, he was evaluated for competency, was found not competent to stand trial, and the statute required that he be released. So he actually, the charges against him were dropped.
So what could have been done instead?
The evaluation now of individuals who are charged with misdemeanor offenses and are evaluated while they're incarcerated awaiting trial, if they're found not competent, they can be remanded to treatment if they're considered to be potentially a danger. So
he would be...
It'd be civilly addressed.
And he would be required to get treatment.
Yes.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that becomes a civil procedure instead of a criminal procedure at that point, because the criminal charges against him aren't pending. But if he's civilly found to be a risk, danger to self, others, gravely disabled, then he can be remanded to treatment civilly on the civil side.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Attaching resources, I discussed that, and then creation of some pilot projects at the state level to demonstrate, in fact, could the state save money and provide more effective treatment by diverting people or linking people at the tail end of their incarceration in state correctional settings, these are serious felony offenders, to treatment. Talk a little bit about the findings in each of these areas. The mental health court. This is an evaluation that the University of Washington and I completed of the Seattle Municipal Court Mental Health Court in 2001. We found that this mental health court was, in fact, serving its target population. We looked longitudinally at 18 months prior to and 18 months post-involvement with the mental health court and found that new bookings for this target population decreased significantly after their mental health court involvement. However, we also found that the average number of jail bed days per booking increased if individuals were rebooked after their mental health court involvement. What this seemed to suggest to us in the evaluation was that we weeded out through this mental health court process the more dangerous and serious offenders. There's a number of new bookings decreased significantly. Those who were rebooked were actually booked on more serious offenses. So the individuals who were those rapidly cycling folks that John was talking about that come through the system repeatedly tended to stay in the community. The mental health court, it was found, effectively linked clients to needed mental health case management, medication, emergency housing, and related treatment and support services, which is to say that by marrying the criminal justice system and the treatment system through the judicial process, something that is increasingly referred to in the literature as therapeutic jurisprudence, the encouragement, the hammer of the criminal justice system court process actually assists individuals in staying in treatment, even in a court setting such as this, which was voluntary. Mental health court participation was associated with an increased number of treatment episodes received over time. And the literature clearly tells us that that increased episodes of exposure to treatment actually promotes increased linkage and improved outcomes. Crisis triage, another program started in the wake of the Dan Van Ho incident and after the recommendation of the MIO task force. The goal of crisis triage is to divert people from the jail before they're booked, to divert people from the hospital before they are committed or voluntarily admitted, and to reduce the use of expensive crisis services, such as the hospital emergency room, as well as to link people to ongoing services and support. In King County, we started a crisis triage program in 1999. It currently serves over 700 people a month. One-third of those individuals are brought to triage by the police, many of them as an alternative to booking into jail. It's very difficult to compute this next statistic, but the estimate based on a scientific survey that's given at admission and at discharge suggests that 25% of the folks at triage are diverted from inpatient hospitalization. That's at an upfront cost of about $500 for the diversion, as opposed to 3 to 5 days of a hospital stay at $5,000 to $7,000. And significant cost reductions are associated with diversion from more expensive resources, such as the jail and hospital. Key lessons learned in all of these different research studies: cost shifting to the criminal justice system is an expensive and losing proposition over time. The research is telling us this now. Our common sense is telling us this now. Many family members and consumers have been telling us this for a long time. Investing in community-based jail diversion programs saves money and lives, but effective diversion requires collaboration and integration. I won't go into the next slide because we're really out of time. Pilot projects represent a modest investment that demonstrate the potential to reduce hemorrhaging of people and dollars from community institutional settings. And finally, this is a really important one, particularly I think in the crisis that Washington State is facing, that Oregon is facing. Spend dollars on what you know works. Evidence-based promising practice models exist and can be replicated. In many systems in many states, we have a lot of sacred cows, programs that have been around for a long time that nobody dares to touch, programs that have questionable outcomes associated with them, yet we keep funding them, we keep replicating them. Increasingly, with the research that's been conducted by the likes of Dr. Osher and others, we know what works. as Ken Minkoff, another distinguished researcher, said, the United States is probably the best country in the world in figuring out what the promising practices are for treatment of people with severe mental illnesses, but we're one of the worst countries in the world at implementing them. So fund what works. Fund the promising practices that we know have an impact for this population. Let me stop there.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the presentation. I do find it, and I've said this before in previous Judiciary Committee meetings, having started my law enforcement career in 1975, my early training was such that if you recognized an individual with mental illness, you didn't arrest them. You took them to a mental health facility. So I just find it fascinating today that we're using, I think as you said, a therapeutic jurisprudence model, a new concept. But for some reason, the existing mental health systems, the asylums, the large facilities that we've downsized and created so-called community-based treatment models, were a miserable failure. And we find ourselves with people with serious mental illness in jails and prisons, and for some reason, we have diverted this to the criminal justice system. Thinking myself some of the functional problems we may have in trying to implement models of this nature. We have, for instance, a mandatory arrest requirement statute for domestic violence. Well, okay, so let me assume as a police officer that I am encountering an individual with a mental health disorder who's also now assaulted his spouse. My requirement is I have to take that person to jail, notwithstanding a very obvious mental illness. So the choices police officers and individuals have to make are becoming much more complex, mostly because of a failure of the existing system. So I that's my complaint. You're right. We need to move someplace else now. And I think the evidence-based models work. And frankly, I'm tired of listening to certified smart individuals who take us into la-la land and never really get us to a point where we're very functional. I participated in the creation of multidisciplinary team models for child abuse intervention, et cetera. I find those models work very, very well. And I'm thinking that maybe multidisciplinary approach to mental health and criminal justice might also work. But we do need that kind of guidance. So anyway, that's my dissertation. Other members may have things to say. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the difficulty in these tight budget times. We have to think of trade-offs. And you mentioned in the state of Washington the existence of sacred cow programs and the necessity to divert funds from them to things that actually work. I wonder if you have any specifics and could kind of give us just a real thumbnail sketch of what the program was, how you managed to divert the money away from it.
Sure. Let me give one example of a program which is actually called the SSB 6002 program. It was Substitute Senate Bill 6002, which was passed by the Washington State Legislature, which was a collaborative effort between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Social and Health Services. That program took $500,000 a year of resource primarily from had been earmarked for the Department of Corrections budget, and was used to target individuals who were exiting the state correctional system, either maxing out or on parole, for very serious offenses. We're talking about individuals with severe mental illnesses who were found guilty of murder, rape, major crimes. We created something called the Community Transitions Project. The Community Transitions Project was a program that was based on some of these promising practice models, whereby individuals from the mental health system and the correctional system worked together to identify individuals who were scheduled for release from state correctional facilities 6 months prior to their release date. 6 months prior to that release date, they were assigned a case manager from the community. That case manager worked with the individual while they were incarcerated to develop a treatment plan. What would happen when an individual who had been incarcerated for 10 or 20 years was returning to the vacuum of the community in comparison to the highly structured environment of a correctional setting? Individuals were linked to specialized housing that was paid for in part by the dollars, $500,000 a year that had been set aside for this program. They had intensive case management services. They were linked to outpatient chemical dependency treatment services prior to their release from prison. All the paperwork that was done, that needed to be done around entitlements for support in the community, were completed and ready to go the moment the person walked out the back door of the prison. What happened in the community, the man who runs the program in Seattle says that that first 24 hours are like flying. That the case manager, when the individual walks out the back door of the prison, is literally flying with that client to ensure that everything is put in place to keep that person safe. The first 24 to 48 hours are critical. They have established protocols with the Seattle Police Department for drive-bys on an hourly basis for the residents where folks live when they leave the prison. Even if they need to stop in and say hello every hour or so, the police are willing to do that to try and stabilize the person in the community. If the person is still on parole, a specialized community corrections officer works with the treatment team to provide the maximum amount of support possible for the individual who's exiting the system. And with that money, the reason DOC was willing to invest that money was that DOC was interested in not seeing those people back again. They didn't want those people violated back to custody because, A, they were very expensive inmates to manage in-house, and B, they thought it would be cheaper and more effective to serve these individuals in the community. The program has demonstrated some very, very promising outcomes. Recidivism rates have gone way down for this population. They are actually able to serve them intensively in the community and begin to titrate the service intensity down over time, reduce the amount of care and attention that they require as they stabilize. But it required that partnership at the state level between two systems that weren't necessarily used to talking to each other at great length, corrections and DSHS. It's now being replicated in specialized programming for DMIOs, as we call them in Washington State, dangerous mentally ill offenders, who now have a resource bundle attached to them as they leave the correctional setting in order to stabilize them in the community. That kind of partnership, that kind of cross-system work where the mental health system is actually reaching into the prison 6 months prior to release date, providing case management, where prison and community staff are working side by side to perform assessments, risk assessments, treatment planning, et cetera, really has demonstrated a very beneficial impact, both in terms of the lives of the individual as well as the state's budget.
Thank you. I think with that, we probably should conclude. You are going to give this presentation again, I think, to the House Judiciary Committee at 1 p.m., is that correct? So anybody that wants to come back in and listen to it again or maybe ask a better question. And I assume that, Bill, you've got contact information for these gentlemen in the event that there are questions you might want to direct to them. So I appreciate you coming in and giving your presentation. It's a very difficult topic, and I appreciate you focusing your efforts and energies on the topic, because we frankly need some advice and counsel and directions to serve how to resolve these complex issues. Thank you very much, and all of you in the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.